What you mentioned there girls being kept at home instead of going to school help the in the homework, that was exactly the same thing in Central African Republic, exactly. But what I saw when they came as grown-ups, they were between 20 and 30 when most of them, 18 and 30, when they came to this school in Carnot, they had the same mentality still, that their wife, as being a woman, didn't really need to be educated in that way. But coming to Carnot, they had to accept that all the women was put into a women's school, learning to read and write, learning whatever else could be necessary and useful in being a pastoral family. So 3 years they had a training parallel with the husband's training. At that time, there were no women students. That came later.
Welcome to the Eden Podcast, where we true the verse of Genesis 3:16, and we discover that God didn't curse Eve or Adam or limit woman in any way.
Eden Podcast, I'm Bruce C.E. Fleming, Executive Director of the True 3:16 Foundation. Our website is tru316.com. That's true316.com. And with us today is Dr. Göran Jansson from Central Sweden. Hello, Göran.
Hello.
Welcome. We're happy to be. We were with Göran and Irma not too long ago, visiting with you in Sweden. And you have a wonderful way for presenting us with breakfast in Sweden. I can't tell you how good it is to sit down and eat with Göran and Irma. Irma's not with us today because she's in prison. Is that right?
Yes.
She's
Every week she's visiting the prison at night as a volunteer, having worked as chaplain before, and they visit part of the prison, around 10, 15 inmates. At such a night. Yeah,
yeah.
some hours.
Yeah. So we hope they let her out and we'll be glad to see you two back together again.
Yeah.
Well, let me give a little brief introduction to your life, Göran. Dr. Göran Jansson is a Swedish citizen. He's a former missionary in the Central African Republic, where he taught at two schools, at the School of Theology in Carnot and at the Bangui Evangelical School of Theology. He taught also at the Örebro School of Theology in Sweden, the Örebro Theological Seminary, which is now known as the Academy for Leadership and Theology. And he's a professor of mission studies and church history with his PhD from Uppsala. So welcome, Göran. We got to know Göran and Irma as they were working in the Central African Republic, and we were too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we go back quite a ways there. That's great.
Yes.
So, Göran, we wanted to ask you, start out with your faith story. How did you come to know Christ and begin to grow in him?
Yes, I'm born and raised in a Christian family. So the Christian faith was something normal in our family. So I was brought up in that context. When I was around 10, I felt a need for some kind of step that expressed my personal faith, that it was not just the faith of my family that I shared, but it was a personal faith. So I went forward in two revival meetings. as a sign that I wanted to express my personal faith in Christ and I wanted to put my life in God's hands. So from that time, I count my, let's say, my conversion. It developed from there. Let me say it in this way, that my family moved sometime after that to Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. And there I was baptized and joined a Baptist church. And the whole setting was so different from the smaller city where I was brought up. So this started to help me to see that my faith was challenged in high school. My faith was challenged in a way that I had to argue, or I had to witness, or I had to involve myself in a way that gave me some kind of credibility. So moving to the capital and the different setting there was important in the development of my faith. And I may also add that the development of my faith is very much linked to the development, the process of my call. I became more and more interested in international issues at high school. I was involved in school associations in that direction. I was involved in a movement for peace in journalism and in politics even for some years. That was a sign of my interest of the outer world. And in local church context, it was the mission issue that was my main interest. But when it came to my role in the future, there were two Bible texts that guided my process of call to serve the Lord. The first was Psalm 32:8. I read it here. I will instruct you and teach you the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you. That text gave me an assurance that over time God would instruct me, counsel me, guide me. And the second text was Proverbs 4:18. The path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day. I had that verse with me as an assurance that things doesn't happen in a second or a minute or even a day or a month. It's a long process. It starts with dawn and it ends with a full day. So that was how I saw my call being worked out.
Okay, so I think we're getting already into our question number two that we like to do, which is how did you, what is your ministry story? So in other words, here you are in Sweden, and the next thing I know, you're in the Central African Republic. Can you tell us about how that happened and then some of the highlights?
At the end of the high school, I was led to study theology, but I hadn't the intention to be a pastor. If someone asked me then, I said rather that I want to teach. I want to be a teacher. And as I was interested in theology, that meant theological teacher. So therefore, I didn't apply at that time to the seminary in my own denomination because that was a pastoral training seminary. So I still had to make my up my mind on teacher, yes, but in which context, and what is the path unto that. So I began university studies in Uppsala, but was soon drawn into a strange period of some months when God step by step guided me, I saw that afterwards, to apply to a newly started evangelical theological seminary in France. I was informed of that by a friend of mine who was at that time spending some time in France, and he had information about that. So it was rather strange, but 3 4 months after this internal process started, I was there in France. I had been accepted. I had my communication with them in English. I was not very fluent in French at all, but I was accepted, and I learned French by reading Greek and Hebrew in French. And afterwards, I could see that this was, I didn't have my intention clear at that time to be missionary or missionary in Africa or missionary in Francophone Africa. But during my 4 years in Vaux-sur-Seine in France, I was contacted by the mission secretary of my denomination. He had heard about me, that I was in France and studied theology in French, and he said, "We have a pastoral training school in Central African Republic. The missionary who is there now is coming home, and we have no one to send there. Can you consider this?"
Now, you weren't blind to the needs of French Africa, because I'm thinking you had some very good friends who were also students with you at Vaux who were from French Africa, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, to study in France gave me the encounter with the Francophone world, with the French language, with the French theological literature, but also, as you say, with African students, even Central African students, being at Vaux-sur-Seine. I was a co-student with Isaac Zokwe, with René Daidanso, and others that I then met at best in Bangui. So God prepared me in all these ways. So when that letter came, I answered after having prayed about it, yes, I am available for that, but I want to finish my 4 years. I don't want to interrupt. It was 1 year left when I got that letter. So they said, "Thank you so much. We are glad for this. And the school will be put on pause, or what you say, for a year, waiting for you to come. And you will have some collaborators waiting for you there." That opened the way to Central Africa. And I spent more or less 4 years there. And then, before leaving Central Africa, going back to Sweden, I got a telegram it was functioning at that time in Central Africa. I got a telegram asking if I could consider, if I could accept to join the faculty of this Örebro Theological Seminary. At that time, the denominational school for pastoral and missionary training. And the president who sent me that telegram, he said, you could answer only with yes or no.
Great.
No discussion, no questions. He wanted a yes or a no.
Yeah, sure.
So I prayed about it and I answered yes. So I went back to Sweden and joined the faculty there. And from that time, I have had those two paths through my whole life: theological education in Central Africa and in Sweden, going back and forth between these two contexts.
Wow. So, and then at that same time, you're raising three children, right?
I married to Irma when I came back from the first term in Central Africa. But
Okay.
when we went back, we went as a family then, yeah.
Yeah, right. Wow. Yeah.
But the experience I had from Central Africa and the mission interest and the missiological reflection that I had been pushed to develop there on the spot made me question the way missionaries were prepared in Sweden. Because at that time, until that time, they had just followed the same 3-year program as the pastors in the pastoral training. They had maybe a language course besides, or an elective on maybe mission history or so, but mainly it was the same thing. So I said that is not possible now in the future. So I started a mission training institute related to the seminary, but in view of preparing reflective practitioners. And they could be pastors having that pastoral training, but they could also be whatever was needed in mission work. But in the Mission Institute, which was a half a year or a full year training, they got what was necessary in relation to mission work. So, I mean, mission theology, mission history, contextualization, cultural adaptation, and a lot of practical things.
Now, when we got to Africa, Joy and I were in Bangui in the capital city. So it was relatively modern. We'd had a couple of years in the villages of in Congo, but one of the students that arrived on campus with his wife, it surprised me. He was there for a master's degree program, and she didn't know how to read. She was illiterate. Why would that hap ever happen in Africa? Did you have any experience along that same line?
Yes, in that school in Carnot, it was quite often like that. Most of the students there had wives who could not read and write. I questioned that, and I didn't get good answers. I mean, some explain that, well, it's like that among our African women. Or some said, well, The men want to be in control, and he don't want to have a wife being educated on the same level as himself. So there were a lot of answers, but mainly maybe they wanted to avoid to answer my question on that issue.
So I experienced that not all the kids were sent to school. You know, some of them were kept at home to work, and maybe if they had to make a choice, it would be the son was sent to school, and the daughter maybe wanted to go, but she wasn't sent because you had to pay. There were school fees you had to pay in the villages we were familiar with in Congo. So that the fellow who came with the wife who was illiterate, I told him, I said, you have 1 year with us. And if you haven't taught her how to read, then that's the end of your year, because we want her to be able to get the training as well as you. And by the end of that year, he had taught her. She was thrilled, and then she was able to take courses that we also offered at the school.
What you mentioned there girls being kept at home instead of going to school help the in the homework. That was exactly the same thing in Central African Republic, exactly. But what I saw when they came as grown-ups, they were between 20 and 30, when most of them 18 and 30, when they came to this school in Carnot. They had the same mentality still, that their wife, as being a woman, didn't really need to be educated in that way. But coming to Carnot, they had to accept that all the women was put into a women's school, learning to read and write, learning whatever else could be necessary and useful in being a pastoral family. So 3 years they had a training parallel with the husband's training. At that time, there were no women students. That came later.
Truth 316 Foundation is the home of the Eden Podcast. Join us for $3.16 a month or more. Let's chew the verses on the key passages on women and men. Go to truth316.com/partner.
Let's pause for a moment, then we'll get right back. I'm Dr. Joy Fleming, co-founder of the Truth 316 Foundation. We mention many great books on the Eden Podcast. We are making them available to you for purchase on our website at true316.com/truebooks. That's true316.com/TRUBOOKS. These books are by our own True 316 authors, such as Bruce and myself, and by our guests on the Eden Podcast. By purchasing these books on true316.com, the True 316 Foundation will be helped with a small commission, and the authors will benefit directly from the sales. We add titles regularly to our site, so check today and do some shopping at true316.com/trubooks. true316.com/truebooks.
True 316 is strengthening and encouraging many, and we're getting stories every day of lives changed through our ministry. We're the home of the Eden Podcast, and we're getting the word out that God didn't curse Eve or Adam or limit woman in any way. Our volunteer help is wonderful, and we grow stronger with each new true partner who gives to the True 316 Foundation so that we can cover the costs to do the technical work of the Eden Podcast, to coordinate our true school workshops like the two-week Eden workshop on Genesis 2 and 3, and to make the True 316 Foundation function in its outreach to scholars and students around the world. You can give now with a one-time gift. And better still, you can join now and become a monthly donor. We call our monthly donors our true partners. Please join now by going to true316.com/partner.